Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. There's this emerging genre of books that I'm very interested in, and it's more just understanding the country.
Yep.
I bought this ridiculously big book about Charles de Gaulle that I'm never actually going to read, but it's vibey, so I keep it. And it's just, he has the quote where he says, like, I have a certain idea of France. And I think your books are important because what people should be trying to do.
Yeah.
When it comes to this fury, when it comes to this moment, it's not, hey, like, here's, I read The Wildland and here's like the 10 policy fixes that will make everyone feel better. It's more, hey, how can you actually sit down and understand the country right now? Because the country is incredibly confusing.
I have to tell you, I'm not going to say this to flatter you, but that is like the single most important insight that anybody has gotten from this book in the entire time I've been, and it's a big, but you've hit on something like really huge, because in a way, look, this question of sort of, you get, there's a literary problem, and then I think there's an intellectual problem with having the, like, at the end of the book, here's the chapter with the 10 easy fixes to get us out of an existential crisis as a nation. I mean, the literary problem is that it looks pretty dishonest in, on a sort of writing level, because you've gone through this process of like excruciating tightening of the screw in every careful way. And then at the end, you're sort of purporting to tell the reader that actually up your sleeve, you have this kind of, you know.
Hope everyone is having a great start to their Thursday. This is another one of these solo episodes that were recorded a few weeks ago. We're excited to be able to post this episode now. I just want to say a quick thank you to everyone who is really supportive when we do these solo episodes. We, as I mentioned before, had a bit of a debate about, you know, if we can't both attend, given our busy schedules, do we sometimes just take a break or do a phoned-in Q&A episode? And I really think, and I think a lot of people here appreciate when we just keep doing episodes and conversations moving forward. I think it's pretty clear that with The Realignment, it's much more about the guest and the conversation we're bringing on and less about hearing Sagar or my specific take. So until we hear a mass audience revolt otherwise, even if Sagar can't make it, even if I can't make it, we're going to keep putting out episodes no matter what. Though, of course, we are obviously at our best when it's the two of us together. But I was excited to do this episode, though. Evan Osnos is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is incredible. This was honestly one of my favorite conversations I've had on this show ever. I know I've been saying that a lot lately, but I've just been excited about how we're getting closer and closer and closer and bigger and bigger and bigger. We just keep doing more of what we're trying to do with this platform, which is to provide a place where everyone could think about the world a little deeper and understand things a little better. Evan's new book is called Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. He previously wrote a book about Joe Biden, the life, the run, and what matters now. And his first book was actually called The Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. And if you actually look at the title of this episode, I called it The Making of America's Fury in the Age of China's Ambition. So what we're trying to do in this episode is tie together the themes of both of Evan's book, Wildland, with the focus on the U.S. from the 2010s into the 2020s, and Age of Ambition, which came out in 2013, 2014. Really when the conversation around China and the country really started to change. So if you read these two books together, which I definitely recommend, you're going to see a portrait of an America that feels just incredibly and obviously, even clichédly, angry, and a China that's ambitious and is changing rapidly. And Evan talks a little bit about how even the book, which was really prescient and excellent, didn't capture the true scale and nature of the changes that were going on in China at the time. So really, really great stuff there. And I just want to really say this too, because I was thinking a lot about the segment that Sagar and I did on Breaking Points on Monday when I was filling in for Crystal. We were talking about Matthew McConaughey, because that was something that actually relates to the episode I'm trying to do here with Evan, and also relates to how people were a little confused what we were trying to say. We weren't trying to say that Matthew McConaughey is the best person ever, or that you should all place all your hopes in him or any other political figure. What we were really getting at, and you should all check the episode, I'll put it in the Substack when it gets sent out later today, was we are increasingly obsessed with taking a step back from this policy position or that policy debate and just looking and trying to understand the country and trying to understand the questions and the even the answers that anyone who's interested in figuring a way out of the current moment should be focused on. what was interesting about Matthew's interview of Kara Swisher that you're referencing was he was taking a step back and saying, hey, like, rather than talk about this specific policy plank, I'd actually like to deal with questions of what actually is politics? What does it mean to work to instill trust? How do you actually build the foundation from which actual politicking and actual policymaking could come? And more, that's just what I'm convinced of. You know, we started the show thinking that everything was about, oh, if the Democrats or Republicans create this specific bill that can do this, this, and that in the Rust Belt, everything will get better. We obviously didn't literally believe that, but to a certain degree, we kind of did. And that just doesn't seem to be true. It seems pretty clear right now that President Biden could come up with the perfect plan to address a lot of the themes of the show, and it just wouldn't pass. I'm pretty convinced that you could see the most interesting or useful Republican candidate in 2024, and they wouldn't be able to accomplish something either. So to Matthew's point, what we are going to keep doing on this podcast and increasingly focus on editorially is just actually taking a step back and having episodes like this one with Evan, where you're not going to come away from this conversation knowing, okay, so Medicare for all, or this tax cut, or this specific policy on campus colleges or on college campuses are going to make things better. But you are going to have a better sense of the country, the world, and this moment that we're living in. Because that, to me, is what the project needs to look like. And as we keep stepping this podcast up for the next few months, we're going to do more and more and more to actually hit those points. So last notes before we get into this episode. Evan, as I said, has three books, Wildland, Age of Ambition, and Joe Biden. They are all available in our bookshop. Please go purchase them there, probably in combination. Could not recommend a different set of books. You can support Evan. You give the realignment a little bit of show support, and you help support an independent bookseller. You could also go subscribe to the Substack, which is going out later this Thursday afternoon. It's really great. I'm actually writing original content. So unlike in previous months, it is not merely just a recitation of episodes you've already listened to. There's going to be original comments, get stuff from the audience, a lot of really great stuff there. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. This has been really great. Let's get into the episode. Evan Osnos, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks, Marshall. Great to be with you.
Let's start by getting you to define the wildland metaphor that is at the top of the title of the book.
Yeah, and you're right to identify it as a metaphor, because I think it can be tempting to just interpret wildland as a description of sort of general political wildness, which is actually not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this slightly esoteric thing, but I think is a kind of powerful metaphor, which is that this is a word that comes out of firefighting, actually. And it's describing the land that catches fire in a wildfire, meaning it's the dried out, desiccated, untended, essentially the deferred maintenance that has been allowed to grow and grow and grow. And eventually all it takes is a spark and things will go up. And from my perspective, it felt that way. Looking at American politics, I said, if it wasn't one spark, it was going to be something else. If it wasn't one political figure, something was going to light that match, because it was about decades in the making. And I guess the way to think of it is that wildland is not a place in technical terms and in firefighting terms, a subject I really don't know much beyond this particularly elegant framework, but it's not a place. It's a condition. It's a set of factors. And that is what drew me to it as an idea.
So obviously we are talking about the United States in the year 2021, but also given the course of your reporting, really during a specific period of the early 21st century. When we, there's good timing. We spoke with Andrew Yang this morning. We had a bit of a debate about what historical period it is useful to compare this one to. The one that you pick, obviously history, not exactly repeating itself, but rhyming. If it's the 1850s, we're in for a complete disaster. If it's the 1880s to 1890s, we're in for a really, really tough time. There are sure to be casualties, but there's something on the other end. How do you think of the historical metaphors as we're thinking about this?
Yeah, that's a fascinating way. And I actually think of it more like the 1890s. And maybe if I'm feeling optimistic, I might even put myself sort of put us at the cusp of the progressive era, at which, after all, just, you know, and your listeners know this, but progressive didn't mean the same thing at the time. It, you know, what's fascinating is that, okay, I draw the 1850s analogy partly to understand the role of belligerence in politics, because there's this really extraordinary body of research that has been done, particularly by Joanne Friedman at Yale, looking at the physical violence in the buildup towards the Civil War. Because as she's described, there was this growing pattern of the resort to force, and that was sort of a sign of political dysfunction, because it was the point at which people, public and ultimately political elites, felt as if they could no longer rely on the rules of the game, that they had to use other means. And that was a tell. And so I think particularly, I mean, I wrote a piece in The New Yorker in October. I mean, it ended up running just before the election. And it was called The Violent Style, because I was describing how violence was becoming a more present fact in our politics. And there's a variety of measures that indicate that. But I actually think in the end, Marshall, that like the more dispositive analogy is not the 1850s, because I think partly because we have that literature, because we lived through that, we won't be fighting the last war. But what we are living through is more comparably a Gilded Age. And that encompasses not just radical income inequality and the degree to which we have sort of escaped the parameters of what had been traditional fluctuations in income divides in this country, but it's also a measure of the way in which you had polarization on a high level. You had demonstrations and sometimes kind of exaggerations, but real demonstrations of public corruption. And more, you know, most of all, you had this sense that the system, quote unquote, was no longer serving a large number of Americans. And that's the analogy that comes to mind. You know, I'm a Mark Twain fan. It's kind of some of the way that I organize my understanding of American history. Twain, after all, was one of the people who gave us the concept of the Gilded Age. And when I came back to this country, we'll talk more about it, but when I came back to this country, I was very much struck by some of the echoes that I was seeing in that period.
I'm glad you referenced Mark Twain and that you referenced, you know, terms such as the Gilded Age and the progressives of the late 19th, early 20th century variety, because the key task, as I understand it, as someone who obviously wasn't alive there, is that what a lot of them did is actually give us language for understanding what we were seeing. So once again, like you said, Gilded Age, you hear it even 100 plus years later, it clearly means something. Obviously, you write about Greenwich, Connecticut, and you're talking about hedge funds and the financial system post 2008, obviously, and that is going to mean something to everyone. So how do you, as a writer and as a person who's undergoing these reported projects, think of the need for and the ability for folks in your line of work to provide new language? Because just to editorialize for a quick second, the reason why I get frustrated in these conversations is it seems to me a large problem facing us is that we don't actually have strong conceptions of what these terms mean. So like take the content moderation debate that you're, you know, seeing on Facebook and, you know, Google, YouTube, et cetera. The issue there is that some people on the right think the public square applies to the internet. People on the left don't think it applies to the internet. And there's not even a shared language there. So that's why I think a key task as we're coming to these issues is using proper language. But I'd love to see how you think about that responsibility even.
Analogies can actually be a bit of a false refuge, because you can easily say, oh, well, we've dealt with this problem before. Therefore, we sort of have the muscle memory of how to deal with it. Like we got out of the last Gilded Age, so we'll figure out how to get out of this one. You know, I think you see that recently. Take, for example, the debt ceiling debate. You know, it was a good piece in Politico pointing out that there have been 78 occasions when we have had to figure out a way out of that particular problem. And on 78 occasions, we have done it. Sometimes it gets very tense to the end, but eventually we do it. And so we will probably do it this time, which is both encouraging, but also if we fail, it will be then the moment when we say, well, failure of imagination. And I've been really struck, Marshall, just in the last like 20 years, the way that a failure of imagination has actually been part of our kind of encumbrance in politics, because this obviously was most dramatized by the invasion of Iraq. And that was a case in which, but you could even predate it. You could say 9/11 was a failure of imagination. One of the analytical frames we use sometimes is to say we never imagined that a guy in a cave could actually pull off this thing that could challenge our fundamental sense of national security. And then, you know, the failure of the invasion of Iraq was ultimately failure of imagination across multiple metrics, including the idea that we would encounter as much resistance as we ultimately did. And you could follow it all the way through to the failure of imagination surrounding the withdrawal from Afghanistan, that we did not imagine the worst case scenarios. And so in a way, I find it kind of thrilling and sort of provocative to say our part of our problem may be that we're kind of resorting to history more often than we should. So I sort of agree with you on that point.
That's interesting. And I want to go to 9/11 because to go back to your, as you said, elegant yet largely uninformed at a firefighting perspective metaphor around a wildland, you specifically referenced tending.
Yeah.
And a lack of tending is causing the conflagration we have right now, or at least the conditions for that. When does the lack of tending come about? Because what's interesting here is, because this is a comprehensive book and you're describing, once again, America in 2021, it's possible to imagine a world where, hey, like, we don't invade Iraq.
Yeah.
Or, hey, something goes wrong with the planning for 9/11 and we just keep going into the 21st century. History is over. Yeah, there's a financial crisis, but like that's the financial side of the country. At least on the foreign policy side, that isn't handled the same way. Maybe it's that the opioid crisis doesn't go the same way because the government is as negligent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can you just describe the opportunity, like where in our history or basically during this period you're describing, does the process start going awry?
Hmm. The way I think of it, like visually, is that it's not that there is one beautiful mountain lake from which this river descends and that's like the point of the origin. I mean, like, you know, I was a big fan of like explorer kind of narratives when I was growing up. And it's like, you know, this is not like Burton and Speke tracing the source of the Nile. This is like something different. This is actually about registering the different tributaries, which ultimately fed into this moment. And, you know, at the risk of combining my kind of urbanite nature analogies, like that actually really helps me understand it. Meaning the headwaters of our crisis had several different points of origin, some political, some economic, some technological. So, you know, to take one example, and this is not one that is a particularly, this is not one that is, you know, that you sort of see every day, but the decisions around some of the more obscure financial structural changes that were made. One of the examples that I mentioned in the book was the decision to allow private banks to go public. This is the kind of thing, it happened around 1969, 1970. And it was, at the time, banks, you know, leading up to that, banks tended to be partnerships that were essentially kind of these clubby enterprises that were designed so that you would come in at a certain point after 30 years of work, you would sell your share on to the next generation and off you'd go. And so there was a sort of somewhat built-in self-protective quality because you never really wanted to either screw your own net worth or everybody else you worked with. And then the banks began to say, we want to grow faster. We want to be able to open up to the public. And so there was this kind of obscure change in the law that ultimately allowed the banks to begin to grow. And they grew and grew and grew. And then it begins part of the story that we all now know, which leads ultimately to Chuck Prince, the CEO and chairman of Citigroup, saying that he was presiding over what had become a financial supermarket. That was the term that was being used at the time, meaning it encompassed every conceivable form of security, every kind of form of exotic instrument that you could imagine. And it was very profitable, but it was deeply, fundamentally unstable. And you know, I love that process, actually, Marshall, of like finding those moments in the historical record that were unannounced at the time, but later are, to use one more nature analogy, that little pebble that sets off the landslide that you only visualize later.
So what are political leaders supposed to do at a conceptual level in the face of all these different pebbles, tributaries, et cetera, because to reference the Yang episode again, just because it's top of mind, we got into a bit of a debate around solutions and whether or not the concept of a solution is a valid metaphor or even concept as we're discussing these things. So for example, you can say that the choices made around bank privatization or public, I said, that's not a word, but going public, that's something you could fix with a policy change. But as we're going to the rage and fury that people are feeling in the country right now, I don't get the sense that changing that policy mistake is the type, or, you know, what's just granted as a mistake, is the type of thing that would ameliorate what people are feeling right now.
But I'll give you a kind of counter example. I both agree, and then there's a way in which I'll disagree. I'm going to first disagree, but then I will actually tell you why I fundamentally agree with that proposition. The way I disagree is that I find it interesting and actually productive to notice the ways in which very specific, arguably kind of obscure technical fixes become fetishized. Example being carried interest. Getting rid of carried interest, we were told in the private equity industry, as we know, carried interest, even to practitioners, carried interest, as people know, is the quirk in the tax code that allows private equity firms to exist. It essentially gives them the ability to tax some of their earnings at the level of capital gains rather than at the level of regular income. And even people in the business will tell you, yeah, it's kind of an amazing bonanza for us. And over the last few years, over the last, 10 or so years, the idea of getting rid of carried interest has gained a public following. People have recognized, like, this actually could be the kind of thing that generates a certain amount of revenue that is not being captured right now by the Treasury. And part of the reason why I mention that is the reason why we end up with a $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation proposal is precisely because there has been so much, to use your word, untended stuff over the last generation, sort of deferred maintenance, almost literal. I mean, as an example, one of the places I describe in the book at some length is Greenwich, Connecticut. And Connecticut, the place where I grew up, kind of an amazing place to be a kid and place to grow up, has the richest 1% in the country and also has some of the worst infrastructure in the country, particularly roads. And the reason why that's remarkable, and there's a lot of explanations for it, obviously politicized on all sides, people will give you different explanations, but it's a remarkable fact. And so I think if you take carried interest as an example, there are ways in which there are sort of specific technical fixes that could begin to diffuse some of this accumulating energy that leads to these kinds of what I think are these sort of precipice moments. That's part of what the problem is in our politics. We have these precipice moments. We don't have a gradual, steady accumulation of iterative progress. It's like we push, we wait, we do nothing, and then we get moments that feel like an existential showdown. And that's why they're very hard to achieve. But the underlying point, I think, Marshall, which you're making, which you identify, I don't know if you would sort of voice this or agree with this or not, but is that it actually is, it's not just technical fixes that are the necessary step. It's actually a mindset shift, because that's the thing, that's what stands in the way.
And what's helpful there is, reading Wildland, I don't take this to be a book where you read this book and you're like, okay, so here's like the 10 policy prescriptions to quote unquote solve this issue. Because the funniest thing, and I'm curious how you think about this, because you're a bit older than me, so we have different entrance points into politics. I'm almost 30. When I came to DC in 2014,
I have socks that are almost 30, Marshall. That's just outrageous. Go on.
We'll survive that one. But I used to be just obsessed with policy. And I think that's probably, and I realize this is also a joke, but it's also true, but I realized to a certain degree that's because my first exposure to politics was my parents watching The West Wing on NBC in 1990. So there actually was this idea that, hey, like what politics is you come up with bills and you do solutions and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And especially when it comes to the media discourse, the other period where I entered into the specific media space was 2015, 2016, 2017, where Bernie has his universal healthcare plan. This politician has this plan. There's think tanks galore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm coming to, especially reading just this book, I think George Packer's work, there's kind of this, I'm not quite sure how to describe.
You're onto something though. That's interesting.
We had George's, George on the show a few months back. There's this emerging genre of books that I'm very interested in. And it's more just understanding the country.
I
bought this ridiculously big book about Charles de Gaulle, but I'm never actually going to read, but it's vibey, so I keep it. And it's just, he has the quote where he says, like, I have a certain idea of France. And I think your books are important because what people should be trying to do.
Yeah.
When it comes to this fury, when it comes to this moment, it's not, hey, like, here's, I read The Wildland and here's like the 10 policy fixes that will make everyone feel better. It's more, hey, how can you actually sit down and understand the country right now? Because the country is incredibly confusing.
I have to tell you, I'm not going to say this to flatter you, but that is like the single most important insight that anybody has gotten from this book in the entire time I've been. And it's a big, but you've hit on something like really huge, because in a way, look, this question of sort of, you get, there's a literary problem. And then I think there's an intellectual problem with having the, like, at the end of the book, here's the chapter with the 10 easy fixes to get us out of an existential crisis as a nation. I mean, the literary problem is that it looks pretty dishonest and on a sort of writing level, because you've gone through this process of like excruciating tightening of the screw in every careful way. And then at the end, you're sort of purporting to tell the reader that actually up your sleeve, you have this kind of, you know, that is not, by the way, in any way an argument against books that are describing solutions. Like, that is a vital, arguably more productive realm of writing than what I'm doing. What I'm doing is a different thing. And what George Packer is doing is in that spirit. And actually, his previous book, The Unwinding, is kind of, I would argue, is probably the closest parallel or model to what I was doing here. And just as a practical matter, his book came out, I think, in 2013 or 2012. Yeah. And I came back to the US that year. And so in some ways, you know, he sort of ended that. And I almost, you know, in a way that he never asked for or would probably agree with, you know, but I sort of felt this need, like, okay, now we have to continue this process of documenting. Because The Unwinding, as you know, is this act of documentation. And I think the genre you're describing that doesn't really have a name is sort of documentary nonfiction right now. Because, and I will resort to Albert Einstein, actually, who had a pretty, you know, that Einstein, people are talking about him, he's going places. But, you know, he had a great line, which he said, if you give me an hour to talk about a problem, I will talk for 55 minutes to describe it, to try to understand it. And maybe I'll talk for 5 minutes about suggesting a solution or two. And I take that idea very deeply.
Not to overpraise. Actually, no, I will overpraise George Packer because his books are really great and I really appreciate his reporting. But, and I'm curious if you have an equivalent insight in the book from your perspective, you could push your own shopwares for a second. But I was, I listened to the book on Audible right after the 2016 election. So we're all during that period of, hey, like, what's going on? Things are crazy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I got to the part where Peter Thiel talked, and once again, like, Peter has his issues, obviously, but I think people need to remember that he said what he said, and I'm about to quote, because it shows that despite everything, he has deep insight. He said, quote, I think people are looking at the country in the wrong way right now. People, leaders who think that people are looking for sunny Reaganite optimism are mistaken. I think there's a darker undercurrent that if someone were essentially, I'm paraphrasing to a certain degree, if someone were to tap into that, they could easily seize political power. And I'm listening to this right after the Trump election. I'm just like, holy shit, like, Peter Thiel actually got it.
He called it.
We can have a whole other podcast about like overlearning lessons from 2016. But I think Peter's quote from George Packer's work is a really useful. If you read that in 2013, the next 3 years of American politics would make way more sense to you on every single level. So I'm curious, within your book, did you have a moment or an interaction that helped, once again, help you better understand the America of 2013 that you came back to during this period?
Yes. And interestingly, it was somebody who is a complicated figure and a very interesting figure. I write about a man in the book named Chip Scowron, who is a hedge fund manager who started out as a doctor, got his Yale medical degree, went off to Harvard to do his fellowship. Eventually he's sort of losing interest in medicine. Somebody says, hey, you should come to Wall Street. Hedge funds are hiring doctors because they want help picking healthcare stocks. And he said, I don't know anything about finance at all. And he literally went to the bookstore and bought a book called Getting Started in Hedge Funds, which I bought a copy of out of curiosity. So I'm now ready to start a hedge fund if you need any help. And he goes off and he does very well. And he makes 30 or so million dollars over the course of a few years. And he moves from one fund to the next fund to the next fund. And then he starts breaking the law. And he starts paying a researcher under the table to get inside information on a drug trial. And eventually he gets arrested, he pleads guilty, he goes to prison for securities fraud. And he comes out of prison and he comes back to Greenwich, Connecticut. And in some ways his life is sort of kind of similar, actually. He's in the same house. And there, you know, one of the metaphors I'm drawing in the book is the difference between his experience of going to prison and coming out for a white collar crime versus somebody who goes to prison for a street crime and comes back out. And the trajectories are very different and kind of just extraordinary in the particulars. But one of the things that's very interesting to me was Chip Scowron came out of prison and he had been he was a Republican. He was a major donor to John McCain. He had been kind of engaged in politics on a abstract level. And his experience in prison, particularly of being surrounded by people who came from very different backgrounds from him and was completely dependent on them. I mean, that was like part of the features of his life, was that he came out and became quite active on issues of incarceration, on race, on structural inequity, structural injustice, these kinds of things. And he said to me at one point, look, the truth is you can't fix what you can't see. And I realized that that's actually kind of a big insight in the sense that it's different from what Peter Thiel was saying. Peter Thiel was capturing sort of the metaphysics, the body language of politics. And in a way, I think part of the reason I remember hearing just, you know, 2 seconds on Peter Thiel is interesting. I remember I was sort of around Silicon Valley a bit doing some reporting in the years leading up to Trump. And I remember somebody commenting to me, and I think Peter Thiel would agree with this, that it was noticeable to them that all the sci-fi in America had become very dark. It was all apocalyptic. It was no longer sci-fi about, you know, building your fortress on the moon and conquering space and so on. And that there was something, almost a sort of unstated message in that we weren't able to express in our ordinary politics. And I think the idea that you can't fix what you can't see, to me, it sounds like the simplest, most banal observation, except that part of the absolute core of my project was making things seen, like describing these connections that are usually undescribed and making them as explicit as possible down to the level of individual people, individual transactions, individual families. So if I say that a decision made by a hedge fund manager who lives in my hometown, Greenwich, Connecticut, had a specific impact on a coal mine, which had a specific impact on the voting behavior of the man named Larry Knissel who works in that coal mine. Like, I almost felt a need to do that because I wanted to say that you can't fix what you can't see.
And the reason why I was setting up the comment around solutions and what's required of the moment is we can basically take it to your recent book and reporting on Joe Biden, because Joe Biden, at least right now, is the politician who is tasked with, at least for the next 4 years at a minimum, sorting through these issues. And we were talking a bit before the episode about, you know, political psychology and how leaders approach certain issues. And what's fascinating to me is that you had a period during the post-2016 era where everyone was hyper just focused on policy. Wonkiness on a variety of levels was in. That was the factor. I think there's an educational and class reason for that. That's a little complicated, but it was the underlying reality of it. And coming into this, you see Joe Biden as a person who isn't fit to meet that moment. He doesn't have the plans. He doesn't hire the wonks. He doesn't have that same style of approach. But at the same time, and I think listeners who are screaming at their phones right now, I'm really talking about candidate Joe Biden. I'm not as well informed on how he actually operates when rubber hits the road. But I was just struck how a politician who took a different era's style of approach was actually better suited to meeting at least the challenges and questions raised by this book. Because I was basically raised to think that 2016 will be determined by the person who came up with the best left behind America economic reindustrialization plan. And on both levels, Trump and Biden, that wasn't true. So I'm just curious how you think about the actual figures in the moment.
You're also asking about essentially the octaves of politics, like which octave works at which moment. Is it like the technical or is it the humane? Is it the hymn or is it like the owner's manual? And there's this cool, I mean, I have this very weird bit of history, which is that, as you know from the book, in 1999, when I was a baby reporter at the Chicago Tribune, I was assigned to cover a congressional race by this like nobody candidate named Barack Obama, who was running in the South Side of Chicago against Bobby Rush. And what's interesting, the reason I mention this is that at the time, and by the way, you know, Obama ends up losing, as we all know. And in the really low point of journalistic history, I ended up taping over my Obama interview because got to save the $2.99 on the mini tape. So
that's
there we are.
That's the most 1999 problem I've ever heard.
Yes,
in no
exactly.
other other historical context will that ever make sense again.
No, you're right. Because like they would have saved the parchment and they would have saved the USB file. But like, alas, the uncanny valley of the late 90s. So what's fascinating to me is that at the time, and I mentioned some of this in Wildland, that there were people around Obama at the time, some who were really inspired by his ability to hit the hymns, to like capture the kind of sweetness and light of American politics. And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. Like it was incredibly powerful. And we saw it in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention. It's why he became president, was his ability to do that. But it always was always a bit misleading because he was also incredibly wonky. And the period that you described, the sort of wonk ascendancy of Washington, was partly a reflection of Obama's reign, because he rewarded that. You know, when you talk to him, his eyes light up if he knows that you've got details on how to bend the curve and these kinds of sort of, I remember once writing a piece in the New Yorker about one of his aides. They use this sort of almost a kind of technical language to describe sociological problems. And that was very specific to that cohort. Mm-hmm. And then there's Joe Biden. And Biden was always kind of outside that world. And, you know, with Obama, it was always both a blessing and a curse. Like when he was running in 99, there was one person who was quoted in the race telling a reporter. So, when Obama spoke to me, he gave me this super technical kind of recitation of problems and how he was going to fix it and everything. And it was exactly the kind of thing that drove some of his advisors absolutely nuts, because they were like, that kind of technocratic talk is not going to get you elected to the first district in the state of Illinois. Like you are going to lose. And he lost. But he took a lesson from that, which was like lean on this other instrument and this other octave of politics. So then you fast forward to 2008. He knows what he can do. He can do the technical side. But he's almost like Obama was almost tone deaf to a certain kind of political language that Biden lives in. You know, Biden doesn't just campaign in poetry. He campaigns in, you know, Seamus Haney and very specifically like Yates. I mean, like that's his thing. And one of the things I concluded in 2020 when he was running was that his moment arrived in politics after all 50 years of sort of slightly missing his mark. You know, he was not the right man in 87. He was not the right man in 2008. But in 2020, at this moment when the United States was, I think, both exhausted by the sort of technocracy of the Obama years and exhausted by the everything Trump of the Trump years, then you have Joe Biden step in and he's essentially singing to us about politics. And we can describe and all the ways in which that was now probably always doomed to encounter the reality of Washington, but people responded to it in 2020 because they were just hungry. And I think that gets to something which runs through some of my book, which is people actually long to be inspired. And this is where I think Peter Thiel's observation that people didn't want Sonny Reaganite bromides. People wanted actually like a dark diagnosis. I think the pendulum always swings. And in 2020, Trump tried to sort of play the hits again, and people were exhausted and they didn't want it. They actually wanted somebody to campaign in poetry again, you know? But then of course you got to govern in prose.
You have to govern in prose. And that's just why at a historical level, I'd like to know your answer to this question. And because these are obviously cherry picked, but the thing that's funny for me is if we look at these different eras that people compare us to positively or negatively, once again, 1850s to Civil War, progressive era, the New Deal, even like mm-hmm. the politicians that we rightfully laud from those periods. So like FDR, we rightfully laud Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Abraham Lincoln. And then like finally, like pre, let's just say Vietnam goes to holy shit, mm-hmm. LBJ, like these weren't policy people. Like I don't think of them as, because once again, like FDR runs positively, but he doesn't run with like, hey, I've got this like kitchen cabinet of people doing the New Deal. And so I'm just wondering, as you think of up and coming politicians moving forward, I'm curious how you see them adjusting their styles and performance to these insights that you're cataloging in the book, but also to these lessons of 2016 to 2020.
I think you hit on an important point too about FDR that is sometimes lost, which is he actually was sort of a pragmatist. We think of him now as a radical, but actually, and this is the piece that Biden taps into. Biden said to me during the 2020 campaign, you know, I find myself in an FDR-like moment. And he was very quick to sort of say, I'm not comparing myself to FDR. He, you know, became a little more comfortable with that later, but like, but what he really was getting at was the idea that there is a pragmatism when the scale of the problem is so grave. And that's the equivalent moment that we're in now. Because if there's one thing that a person takes away from my book, and I've loved the fact that people who have read it have said to me essentially like, you know, there are these kind of statistics in the book that are like the kind of thing that you like walk around with and like dine out on it at a cocktail party, because that's, I sort of live my life that way as a reader. I'm like a hopeless highlighter. I'm constantly like, books are just, you know, embarrassingly covered with post-it notes because I'm like, I find these things that give form to these problems of such size that I have to be able to like identify them in dramatic terms, because I think that's the only way to drive it home. And somebody who, to take an example of a rising cohort of politicians, somebody who I think is quite good at marrying the poetry with the owner's manual is Pete Buttigieg, because you will not often catch Pete Buttigieg out, meaning like out in terms of not knowing his facts or not knowing how to make something sing and how to actually meet people on a deeper level. So he can do, you know, he can do the grist and he can do the grace, I think, to use two terms I hadn't put together, but I think that's like, that's part of what, and there's a reason why somebody like Pete Buttigieg may, I'm not particularly good at predicting who's gonna work in politics and who's not, but every once in a while you do come upon people who have that combination. And it also helps, I would say, not to be duplicitous and nakedly self-enriching. I would say those two things are also not a big win for you in politics right now. And I'm not going to go into who it is that I think is, you know, duplicitous and self-enriching, but like there's a lot of that in Washington. I'm talking to you from Washington. I mean, this is my home, but it is not a place that Americans are like really moved at. This is a breaking news here, but people are not moved by the selflessness of Washington. And I think on a deep level, that has a ruinous effect on the ability for anybody to break through that cynicism.
Yeah, in our last section here, I want to capture the, you know, country that you moved to moved from to Washington, which is China, because obviously, you know, your first book was The Age of Ambition, which is Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. So a couple of questions here. The first question would be, Age of Ambition came out at a really interesting time, in the sense that I think if this book came out in 2011, 2007, I'm not quite sure it'd be worth recommending as a reread. No offense.
Sure.
But I think as a pure historical artifact, aside from it being well written and interesting, this comes out right before everything on China changes. So just at that specific moment, I find that very interesting. So could you just speak as, you know, as a reporter, as a writer, about how America's approach and conception of China has changed in the period between these two books? Because, like, once again, like, listeners know this, but if there's one thing Trump actually did, it's that he actually forced, for good or for ill, the conversation on China to change in a way that even Hillary Clinton pursuing a modified version of the TPP wouldn't have done to the same degree. So I'm just curious how you think about the dynamic I'm describing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I think there's a couple things that are happening. One is that I came back in 2013, and, you know, I write, apparently, I didn't sort of intend to do this, but apparently I write my life in 8-year segments. You know, my wife was like, "You're like a cicada. Every 8 years or something, you come out with a book about our life." But the 8-year period I was describing in China could be actually described as essentially the run-up to Xi Jinping. It was sort of the Olympics in Beijing, which was this moment of openness, this kind of, this now what we now know to be this very illusory commitment to globalized values, the sense that China wanted to participate in an international system, not be a disruptive force. That was the, but, you know, and you know this from the book is actually sort of this building sense of tension between the individual and the authoritarian system and the feeling. And I think the thing that, if I was going to do it differently now, one thing that I completely did not understand was the authoritarian potential of technology. I interpreted technology at the time to be a liberating force. And so, you know, you see kind of the way it was going. And of course, it was not. It ended up being marshaled in service of sustaining the Communist Party, not challenging it. That's probably the single biggest change. And, but to your point, but, you know, one of the interesting things, and this kind of picks up on the, what we were talking about earlier about, like, point of origin and the tributaries that contribute. In the China want crowd, where I spend about, you know, a good portion of my time, the one of the points of discussion is, when did the authoritarian turn start? Did it start with Xi Jinping, or was it already underway beforehand? Because if it was already underway beforehand, that's actually a more serious problem. Because in a way, if you can say, well, it's just Xi Jinping, you say, well, if we can just get rid of that guy, well, then maybe the system will kind of will return to our, what the George H.W. Bushes of the world imagined China would do, which would gradually open up in the direction of
democracy. Yeah, he's 66. It's a long century. Because this is the thing, which is, because what you're getting at, for listeners who don't know context, he's 66 years old. He, you know, it's a long century. Like, when we're talking about, is the question, is this a personal conflict or is this structural? Is there, like, a structural, and it's interesting, we recently had Bridge Colby on the show.
Sure.
And, you know, Bridge writes about the fact that, like, hey, like, it's possible that even if China were democratic, for structural reasons, you could still actually have conflict between the two countries. So that's actually why the debate you're articulating is actually, like, a very important one that matters beyond just, you know, wonky foreign policy circles.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is, you know, if Xi Jinping, you know, dropped dead tomorrow, what would happen to the direction of China's foreign policy ambitions? What would happen to its confrontation with the United States? And I think the answer is, it would continue on. I think, you know, Bridge would certainly agree with that, that it kind of goes, it continues to move in the direction of these kinds of structural underlying problems. And you could draw that same analogy. You could draw that same analogy to the United States. I mean, I think, and this is where, in a way, you know, I somewhat depart from the great man theory of politics, which, look, in Washington, we practice that. You know, if you want to talk about what's happening, you talk about Trump, you talk about Biden, you talk about Manchin, you talk about Nancy Pelosi. But actually, I'm a big believer that these underlying structural forces, the kind of historical momentum and the facts that are more durable than one individual politician, are the makings of destiny, and that we don't actually pay enough attention to them. And that's part of the reason why I sort of wrote this, you know, the reason why Wildland is almost like a book with a Trump-shaped hole at the center is because I didn't feel like I needed to give us more understanding of how he thinks and operates. We know that. He's a very apparent person. What I wanted to understand was how he became possible.
I don't want to say, how do you rate, I'm saying it now, but like, I don't want to purely, literally say, how do you rate like the U.S. against China? Because at a literal level, it's kind of a stupid question. To a certain degree, like, there's a fun statistic in one of your pieces about China, which was that, hey, like a billion Chinese citizens have never ridden on an airplane before. So yeah. Just saying like purely, hey, like is China better than the US is to a certain point, like misleading, not particularly helpful. So a better way of putting it is, how do you compare the narratives of the two countries? Because that's oftentimes what people on the Chinese and the American side are both doing here. It's once again, like the question in the 1980s wasn't literally like, is Japan going to conquer the United States? The point was there were these specific challenges the country faced that at a metaphorical level were represented by Japan. That's what people were actually talking about. So how would you compare the narratives today?
I love that. It's such an interesting question. And the most, I think, important distinction, the nub of it, is that Chinese people today are more willing to sacrifice for their country than Americans are today, which is a provocative thing to say, but it's actually true, because part of it has to do with how close China has been to poverty in its recent history. In our lifetimes, there was cannibalism during the Cultural Revolution. Like, that's not an abstraction. And it was politically driven, but it was rising out of a position essentially of sort of desperate human condition. And part of what I'm getting at in this book about the United States is, whether you're a conservative or a liberal, I think we can all agree that we're living in a narcissistic time, like a time of essentially putting oneself ahead. I mean, the fact that the number of Americans who have given genuine sacrifice of a kind that we would have recognized during World War II, meaning really disrupting your life, really giving something up in your personal economic life or your professional ambitions in order to make a gift of service to this country, that is just a tiny marker of what I think of as a weakness, actually, a kind of character weakness at this moment. And I don't say that as a compliment to China. Like, I worry actually that, like, you know, China is prone historically and in contemporary terms to these moments of kind of collective delusion about politics. And they have been whipped up into nationalist frenzies before, and I'm afraid they will be again. We have too, in different ways and on a different scale. But one of the things that really strikes me is, look, I'm a very lucky person. I was born with a lot of advantages. I went to a great school. I got essentially all the kind of gifts this society can give a person. And it does worry me that when I look at my cohort, I don't see people coming out and sort of dedicating themselves to advancing this country on a broad base. I mean, just as a technical matter, the number of people who I graduated from college with who immediately went off and went to Wall Street was very different than how it might have been three or four generations earlier. And I worry about that.
So I've got to ask this very precisely so I can hit one other point, but I'm really interested in your reference to sacrifice. I want to know what that means, because to the start of the conversation, we're talking about what do these words mean and how are these words wielded? Because my concern becomes, if sacrifice is what you describe, especially in the comparison to folks going to terrible, 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 totally shameful, mostly kidding, management consulting jobs or Wall Street jobs that are just comfortable and will help you be upper middle class, but don't really, I think, offer the best you can do with the education you have. Sure. The concern, though, is when sacrifice is used politically during a hyperpolarized time. So, like, what I'm concerned about is people saying, well, you know, Republicans just aren't willing to accept AOC's Green New Deal plan. They're just not willing to sacrifice for the climate. So that's not to say that I don't think catastrophic climate change is like an existential threat. That's not to say that something needs to be done. But when the word sacrifice is used in politicized contexts, I think it effectively loses its ability to mean anything. And it actually leads political actors to not understand what they're talking about. So, for example, the discourse I hate is the like national service discourse. I hate national service discourse because the generic term, and this is just like a center left, like, you know, Thomas Friedmanite, no offense, Thomas, point of like, hey, like, what if we could get together as like 18-year-olds and do this, this or that? It's like, look, a technocratic program like that will be received so poorly by the right in this country. If you think it's the 1930s and we're doing the Civilian Conservation Corps, like, you do not, once again, to the point of where I think your book is important, understand the country. Because if you do not understand that the next day after you propose that actual idea, Madison Cawthorn is on TV saying Joe Biden wants America's woke core to do this, this, or that, like, you don't understand what's going on. So can you just speak to like the word sacrifice in the context? Because once again, I'm not pushing back against the idea of national service or the Green New Deal. I'm talking about language that is used in a politicized moment in the country.
So I'm going to put it in real life terms, because I think it drives it home pretty clearly. In this town of Greenwich, Connecticut, which I describe in Wildland at some detail, you know, where I grew up, George H.W. Bush grew up there. And George H.W. Bush, as we all remember, was the youngest pilot in the Navy. I mean, when World War II began, he signed up, he went over, he was a certified, genuine war hero. Just kind of an amazing story. And actually, the details of him surviving that are kind of amazing. We sometimes sort of treat that heroism as just a thing, like a kind of token on his biography, but actually it runs deep. I mean, his nickname as a kid in school, in town, was Have Half, because he was so pre-wired by his family to say, I'm going to give away half of what I've got. He would give away half of his stuff on the playground. And that didn't come from nowhere. His father, Prescott Bush, who was the more or less the most powerful politician in town, eventually was a senator from the state of Connecticut. He was famous for basically saying, look, I get it. I don't want to pay any more tax than I need to, but we have to pay taxes in order to have a functioning education system, functioning research and development, and to make up for gaps in how we were born. Full stop. And that was more or less put him, he was, you know, he was Dwight Eisenhower's golf partner. Like, that was the center of Republican thinking at the time in the 50s and 60s. Fast forward to 2013, and another resident of Greenwich named Thomas Foley ran for governor. And he was a private equity executive who had a collection of classic cars. He owned two British fighter jets. He lived in a house that the local paper described as comparable to the Hogwarts castle. I had to look up what that was because I'm old. Then when he produced his tax returns, because that's what you do, they showed that he had paid $673 in federal tax the previous year because of investment losses and alimony payments. And look, the answer, there's nothing illegal about that. He was using the law as it's been shaped. But the fact is, that is a level of, shall we say, impoverished sacrifice that in the end has consequences. Like, the country just simply cannot function in the way that the Bush family might have imagined that it could, you know, three generations ago. And I think the part of the reason, you know, I'm sort of, my tongue is a little bit in my cheek here in the sense that, like, I can make a whole series of reasons why I think, you know, Bush family politics got the United States into all kinds of messes. But I'm actually just trying to isolate that point about the idea of how much do all of us need to put our skin in the game. And I'm struck in very contemporary terms by the fact that that one half of 1% fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. That had profound effects on this country. That's actually as much a conservative point as it is a liberal point. Now, you can make a case that in military terms, yes, we don't have a conscripted military that's more technically proficient and so on. But we got to figure out a way so that we fight a war together. We don't have it just sort of hived off to the people who are unlucky enough to have to do it. That's peace. That's what I'm sort of getting at. And we don't have to call it service, because I actually think your point is exactly right, that if it's something that Joe Biden trots out and just says, all right, everybody, you got to sign up and go do this, that's not going to work. What we actually have to do is figure out how to valorize it. And, you know, people like Stan McChrystal, who are genuine war heroes in the eyes of the left and the right, would tell you, we've got to figure out a way to figure out how to build that sacrifice component into our national culture for young people, or we're really on a trajectory towards weakness, not strength.
So for the last quick question here, I want to end on a positive note. You specifically referenced we could be entering something positive, something akin to that progressive era after this period. Just give us a closing out why you think this period could lead to something better.
Well, I'm a big believer in that American politics moves in these really distinct cycles. One of the things that I've noticed from having lived in authoritarian countries is our special sauce is that we have this capacity to self-correct. We just do. Part of it was the founders built it in. It's kind of handy that every 4 years we get to have a do-over. But as a practical matter, we have this ability that whatever it is that we've been doing and kind of contending with and getting frustrated by, we do move away from it. And you see this over and over throughout the course of American history. You know, the progressive era was, it's fascinating that you had all three major presidential candidates running under the progressive label at a certain point, even people who didn't consider themselves kind of small P progressives, because that's where the country moved. And the progressive era gave us some pretty important features of our modern life, like public high schools. And there are ways in which I think we are coming to terms with the fact that we kind of took a little holiday for about 30 or 40 years from some important investments in the functioning of the country. And we want to be strong, and that requires making some sacrifice for the next few years. And I'm personally prepared to do it. And I think a lot of people are. And I think if you press people, you'd say, yeah, I'd rather have a strong country than a weak country.
Really well said. Evan, thank you so much for joining. The book is Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. Definitely check out The Age of Ambition and his book on Joe Biden. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.